and welcome to High and Low, a Curacao podcast with your one co-host, me, Spencer, and, well, this other guy, he's something.
It's not a Curacao podcast anymore, Spencer.
Well, this episode is a very special... Well, say who you are.
My name is Joel, and we're switching directors.
It's a very special episode where we're going to talk about someone besides Kurosawa for once. Well, Kurosawa will probably come up again, but we're going to talk about a little director who called by name of Seijun Suzuki.
This is one of those episodes that'll get us nominated for a daytime Emmy because it teaches you a lesson. Yeah, like, stay out of refrigerators and junkyards, and don't let the guy who owns the bike shop molest you.
Yeah, and, you know, stuff like, don't join the Yakuza, because probably won't end well.
That's a pretty good lesson, yeah.
Yeah, and if you join a clan of prostitutes, you know, follow the rules.
Mm-hmm. And just because you think a guy is a simple policeman, he's probably also a really good detective.
True. All right, so, well, first, what's your general opinion on Suzuki? Do you like him? Do you not like him?
Based on the four movies that we've watched, mm-hmm. I do like his stuff a lot. It's just a general peppering. Some of it's kind of incoherent. It's kind of jumping time all over the place. It's pretty violent, risque, to say the least.
Yeah, and to him, time doesn't matter.
A heavy use of Joe Shishido.
Yep, puffy cheeks.
Yeah, he's got a weird face, and I like the work he does.
Joe?
Yeah, I like the work Joe does, and I like the work that Suzuki does. But that's my personal opinion. Let's hear yours.
I appreciate the technical and interesting and artsy side of Suzuki's work, but some of it just doesn't connect with me. And I'm not exactly sure why, but there's something about it just doesn't... It's nice to look at, but then, like, I care about story, and Suzuki never cared about story.
Well, I think that it depends on the movie.
Well, yeah, true.
Because one of them we're going to talk about has a very linear story. The other three, yeah.
I don't know, like, to me... I've seen seven of his movies, and I started watching them when I first got Netflix because I suddenly had all this access to old movies I'd never heard of, so I packed on a bunch of Japanese movies, and I kind of happened to see a bunch of Suzuki and Kurosawa and Ozu and Mizoguchi, and the Suzuki ones always left me a little disappointed, but at the time I didn't get his style was so experimental. But now, a few years later, I appreciate his work. I like the look of his movies. They're very visually interesting. Like, we can't describe what it's like to watch one of his movies.
No, I mean, especially since we come across with completely different experiences. Like, but to try to compare him to, say, Akira Kurosawa, they're not very much alike.
Yeah, not at all.
Even Kurosawa's more gangster-like films, like Drunken Angel, The Bad Sleep Well, you know. I feel like there's other things, but
Stray Dog. No, that's Police Story.
Yeah,
I can't think of any Yakuza movies he did.
He has more of a straightforward narrative. He's got a very cinematic style, for lack of a better term. Like, if you look at him, it's like, take a chunk of his movie, you got Oscar clips left and right. And that's not obviously, we're not putting down Kurosawa. I'm not trying to put down Kurosawa. I'm saying that he has a specific style of filmmaking. And Suzuki's is way more trashy.
Yeah, he made B movies where Kurosawa made A movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so out of four movies we did, well, yeah, we'll get to that later. So, well,
History lesson.
Yeah, a bit on his life. His birth name is Satoru Suzuki. He didn't go by Seijun until 1958 on the movie Underworld Beauty, which is a movie I saw. And it was the first one of his I saw, and I really hated it. I might give it a chance, but there's a reason it's not one of his, considered one of his classics, I think. It's not even on Criterion, so.
Yeah.
But, so didn't find much about his early life or family life, but he was born May 24th in 1923. He tried to get into agriculture college, but because he wasn't good at science, he didn't get in. So he went to like a smaller college, maybe community college. I don't know. This says a small college, and but then he got drafted into World War II. And so he served some time in World War II. He was in the Navy, and he was shipwrecked twice, and both times rescued. And the second time, he was drifting at sea for about 4 to 5 days.
Nice.
Yeah, and he spent time in the Philippines and stuff. Probably killed some Americans, but, you know, he kind of had to.
That's okay.
Yeah. The war wasn't his fault. He was just, you know, he was drafted. He didn't have a choice.
Right.
Let's see.
I'll have you know that on Letterboxd, Underworld Beauty has a average rating of 3.4 out of 5.
Well, some people like it.
Yeah, but only 193 people have actually watched it on the site, at least. So that doesn't do for very good for average rating numbers. Like, you want to get way higher than that to actually know if the consensus is it's good. Tokyo Drifter, for instance, has 4,456, and the general consensus is 3.8.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
All right, so after he served time in the war, he went back to college, and he studied film, and he says here, passed the entrance exam for Shoshiku Studios. And he worked with director Noboru Nakamura, which is a name I recognize. I may have seen some stuff by him, but...
Spell that for me.
Nakamura?
Yeah.
Nakamura.
Noboru Nakamura. All right. Keep going.
All right. Yeah, so...
Oh, wow. And,
what? He does a lot?
I'm looking at movies he starred in. Looks like he was an actor.
Oh. I guess maybe actor and director?
I don't know. Oh. I'm seeing... No, it looks like he was just an actor. Nobuo Nakamura starred in Tokyo Story, Akira, Throne of Blood, High and Low, The Bad Sleep Well. Yeah.
Oh, it says he worked as an assistant director under Nakamura. Okay. Like maybe he's worked on his movies, I guess.
Yeah.
So then in 1954, Suzuki transferred to Nikatsu Studios, which was his mainstay for about 13, 14 years. And at that studio, they had him make basically the cheap, fast B-movies. He did, like, some softcore porn, Yakuza stuff, pretty much. And I watched the thing was on Tokyo Drifter, the bonus stuff on Filmstruck.
Yeah.
And his cinematographer. They worked with a lot.
Greg?
Shige Yoshi Mine. I was talking about working with Nikatsu Studios, and you were given pretty much enough money to make the movie, and that was it. And you were given 25 days maximum to shoot everything.
Mm.
And because he had 25 days, there was no time for rehearsals. And so no director at the studio, according to this interview, really did any rehearsals.
Mm.
And he said pretty much the only director that could make the movie could finish shooting early was Suzuki. Not pretty much no one else was able to work at that pace. Everyone else needed the full 25 days for everything.
Right.
And in the interview, Suzuki said that rehearsals were for big shots like Mr. Kurosawa.
Big shot.
Yeah, big shot.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. So Suzuki, much like Kurosawa, was a big fan of American Westerns.
Mm.
Which shows, especially in Tokyo Drifter.
Yeah.
Because that's this straight up a Western. And, so his key crew that he worked with a lot were the cinematographer, Shige Yoshi Mine. His composer was Niaozumi Yamamoto. His art director, Takeo Kimura, and his editor, Akira Suzuki.
Mm.
And this team worked on, not the full team, they kind of did other stuff too, because they were all contracted to the studio.
Right.
Studio system stuff.
Yeah.
But they worked on his most iconic stuff at that point in time. And so, Suzuki's first movie came out in 1956.
Mm.
I can't find the English translation for the title, but in Japanese it's Minato no Kenpei Shori o Waga Teni. I'm not sure what that means in Japanese, but...
Perfect. That was perfect Japanese.
I'm just like Richard Gere.
Just like him. Let's see. What year was that?
56.
56.
Yeah, I can't find much information about this movie at all.
Okay. And
his last movie was called Princess Raccoon. It's a fantasy musical he did in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he had a career lasting... almost 50 years.
Yeah.
Which is pretty impressive.
As a director, exclusively.
Yeah, the director.
Yeah. So I'm looking at Letterboxd, and he's got two movies from 1956 on here. Mm-hmm. One is called Victory is Ours, and the other is called Satan's Town.
I'm not sure which is the one.
It says Satan's Town is Akuma no Machi, so that's not it. It must be Victory is Our Own, which the translated, it is not translated into, whatever the version of Japanese that is put into English letters. It's just that. So I'll bet that's what it is.
Yeah, it has to be it.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, so early in his career, he was just making like cookie cutter Yakuza movies and softcore porn and other stuff for a studio. And he kind of, this is just speculation. I imagine he got bored making normal movies, and so he kind of started doing more weird, interesting stuff. And
yeah, started having a little fun with it.
Yeah, like he said in interviews that his goal during the first part of his film career was just make movies that were fun and memorable.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really care about like story or like whether or not critics will like it. As long as audience liked it, you know, that was the main goal.
Oh yeah, he's a real Kevin Smith. I didn't make this movie for the critics.
Yeah, because like critics at the time, well, early on were kind of like, you know, it's just a B Yakuza movie, and then in the early '60s with Youth of the Beast, I think that was the first one where he really went out there, like went like off the reservoir and just really did his like crazy color and, you know, the stuff he's real famous for.
Yes.
And so he did a couple, so he did Youth of the Beast, Gate of Flesh, two more movies in the Flesh trilogy, Tokyo Drifter and Branded to Kill, and he got more experimental, and the studio kept having issues with him making weird experimental movies.
Yeah.
And Branded to Kill was such a disappointment in the box office that they used that as an excuse to fire him.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Because they said, quote, it's incomprehensible, which it is.
That's interesting. If you look at, I'm looking at the, on Letterboxd once again, at his movies in order of release, and if you look all the way down from the beginning to Branded to Kill, you can see like a change in like just the way the covers or posters look, because obviously it's a different, he must have had to move on to a different studio. So it's like, there's the line right there.
Yeah, so after he got fired from Nikatsu Studios in 67, he went to TV, because I can't find if he quit making movies or if he just couldn't get any work. But he came back after 10 years of doing TV and like corporate commission stuff. And then he became an art house art film director.
Yeah, I can tell.
And then critics loved him, because they finally were like, okay, we get it. Because he's not, I imagine probably because he wasn't making like a sleazy B movie.
Right. He was doing something more that they could recognize as like an auteur doing something like that, which is funny because his older work was auteur work. It was like, hey, this is my take on it, and look at how good it is. Like, what?
Yeah, like, I saw him in articles compared to Mario Bava and Roger Corman, where they just took trashy movies and kind of elevated them into something like bizarre and interesting.
Sure.
I think so.
Roger Corman?
Yeah, I've seen him compared to Roger Corman.
I guess.
Some Roger Corman is fun, some is garbage.
I think he was pretty all over the place. You know, he didn't have like a.
Well, this is one article that said he liked Roger Corman.
Certainly. I'll take it.
But as a Mario Bava fan, I see the parallel of Mario Bava just made like kind of trashy, like Italian B movies, but yeah. His color palette is just like very strong, and the set design is really interesting. He's kind of made these weird trashy movies like Lisa and the Devil, where Kojak, who is this guy?
I don't know. Kojak?
The 70s show.
Yeah, I know the show, but I have no idea.
Actor's name.
Is
it? Anyway, he plays the devil in it.
Is it Greg? No.
Bald guy. He is in the Living Doll Twilight Zone episode.
Oh, of course.
All right. I'll look it up later.
Comparing him to Italian directors makes sense to me because they do a lot of things that are essentially trashy. Or like back in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. they did a lot of trashy movies that came off as very high art because of soundtrack and the way they were shot and the environments and stuff like that. It's like, this is a Western about a man who gets a prostitute and she ends up dead. Nope, but this guy shot it really well. Horror movies, same thing. All kinds of horror movies.
Yeah. Telly Savalas is who I'm trying to think of.
Yeah, I don't know who that is.
Oh, he's he was Jennifer Aniston's godfather.
All right, old man.
They're both... Telly's dead.
Oh, okay.
But they're both, like, Greek or something.
Oh.
Anyway, yeah, so... Suzuki made a big comeback, and he was a critical darling, and then, yeah, things kind of, you know, worked out. He kept making movies, and then he retired after Princess Raccoon, and he passed away earlier this year in February.
Mm-hmm.
He was 93 years old.
Yeah. So, you are here to make this poor, recently passed away old man feel bad about the movies. Is that what we're doing here?
Yes.
Right. You want to spit on his grave because you don't understand. Well, which one do you want to talk about first?
Okay, so
the four that we picked out to talk about.
Oh, there's another movie he directed that I think you'd be interested in from the 80s.
Is it The Lion King?
Oh, no, it's Lupin the Third and The Goal of Babylon.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. The Legend of the Gold of Babylon, 1985.
Yeah.
Why would I like that movie? Man, if you could hear me complaining to my niece about her not watching anything but cartoons, let me tell you.
I thought you liked anime.
I don't hate anime, but I don't go out of my way to watch it.
Yeah, so, yeah, we watched Tokyo Drifter, Branded to Kill, Take Aim at the Police Van, and
Gate of Flesh.
Yep.
That's right.
Let's go Take Aim at the Police Van, because that's the one I remember the least.
All right. Well, that's not going to help. That's the one I watched a long time ago. 1960, Take Aim at the Police Van, directed by Seijin Sezuki. It is in the Nikatsu Noir Eclipse Series box, which is number 17 from Criterion. It is one of a few movies that I first watched when I was just getting into film, which I wasn't into film until maybe the last decade. Which, I know, you know what, that's not even true. It's been like 6 years, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally, like, decided, okay, I'm going to embrace this. And I started getting into that stuff like crazy. And this is one of the movies where I was like, oh my gosh, there's so many things that I need to go see. This is basically, it is a very straightforward story compared to the other things we're going to talk about. A man.
Yeah, this is before he went, like, full experimental.
Yeah. It's a man who is a prison guard, and they are transporting a bunch of prisoners when their bus is attacked by a sniper. And because the prison guard, who is the main character of the movie, is, you know, responsible for the safety of the prisoners on the bus, he gets suspended. Although it's not, you know, it's not really clear why he's suspended. It's just police rules, whatever. But he takes it upon himself to figure out why the bus was attacked in the first place. Not because he wants revenge or anything like that. It's almost like he just has this curiosity, you know, this mystery that he feels like he needs to solve. Yeah. And he's...
I'm going to say it feels like a Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, it definitely does. It definitely does. But it's pretty interesting to me how... You take somebody who, like I said, he's a prison guard, and if you think of prison guards in America, you don't think very complimentary about them.
Well, my brother-in-law is a prison guard.
Okay, is he really cool detective, dude?
No, but he's a good father of two kids.
Well, who gives a shit about that? I'm talking about detectives. Because this guy takes it upon himself, and he's like following clues, he's following leads, he's getting shot at and dodging bullets and like investigating people. Some guy tries to assault him, and he like takes the gun away from him. The main guy in this is a really great protagonist, and I think it's just like a super enjoyable movie. It does have the disadvantage of being not that original when it comes to Japanese or even American like films, like you said, very Hitchcock like.
Yeah, it's. I think he like Kurosawa and I can't think of anyone else really liked Western movies, like American and like British and stuff. Not like, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do know what you mean. I'm sure there are a bunch more that took their influences and wore them directly on their sleeves, but we haven't, that's the thing about, that's why we're even freaking doing the podcast, because we haven't even scratched the surface. There's so much deep diving in these, auteurs of Japan that we need to get into. Yeah. And even recognizing things, this film has originality. Like, there is no, you would not see, at least I'm not familiar with the Hitchcock movie, where the protagonist is kind of a badass, even though he looks like a schlumpy guy. Like, this guy is not, like, super fit or anything like that. He's just a guy. Yeah, he kind of looks like an older man, but he knows what he's doing. And he's not, you know, he doesn't get dicked around.
I don't know, maybe like Cary Grant in the Hitchcock. I don't know.
Cary Grant plays
Cary Grant.
He plays Cary Grant, but like, you know, his most famous one is
North by Northwest.
North by Northwest, and there he's just kind of stumbling along, like he's just like along for the ride against his choice, really. So he's not dedicated to finding out anything except for why people are after him. And he's not a badass, but he's also not unskilled. Now, this is like if Liam Neeson in Taken wasn't just ready to snap everybody's neck. Like if he was like a police officer and was still trying to follow the law.
yeah, I see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, my favorite thing about Take Aim was in the beginning, in the credits, it would be a spotlight on a sign, and that would be like someone's name.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. And he repeats that in Tokyo Drifter a bit. There's like a lot of, there's like using a sign to designate like a character.
Yeah, creative use. And the camera work is really well done. You know, I'm surprised to hear that this was just like a low budget, I'm going to do this real quick kind of movie, because I do think that the shots are well thought out. I think that the environments look, you know, as good as they can. And, you know, maybe that's where they saved on the budget, because it is just basically room to room or a small shot on the street.
Yeah, like the set director said, pretty much they had no money to really build a set ever. And so they would find creative and cheap ways to make a set.
Yeah.
So, like, got anything else on Take Aim?
No, I just, I'm being complimentary, that's all. I think people should see this movie.
It has, of the Suzuki movies I've seen, it's the best opening.
All right, what about Gate of Flesh? You want to talk about that one next?
Uh-huh.
Gate of Flesh
is basically Golden Girls, but they're prostitutes in post-war Japan. It's kind of Golden Girls-esque.
Golden Girls if they were all prostitutes.
Yeah.
I've never seen a single episode of Golden Girls, so I wouldn't know.
You're missing out.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah. You got a Blanche. You got a... Never mind. Anyway.
Well, so, who's the feral one?
I guess the red one?
Yeah. Wait,
in Golden Girls or the movie?
No, yeah, the feral one in Gate of Flesh. Who is she the equivalent Golden Girl?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Okay, anyway, so, yeah, these four women are prostitutes, and they don't need a pimp. They just do it on their own. Pun intended.
Yes.
And they take in a new girl, and, she's following the rules, and they have one rule. Remember what it is?
No, I don't.
Don't give it away for free. Always get paid.
Oh, that's right. There's a girl in the beginning of the movie who does get caught giving it away for free, and they do a very humiliating thing to her.
Yeah, the punishment is you get tied up to a pole and beaten.
Yep. They cut your hair, don't they?
Yeah. And then they tie the person nude on a boat and just leave her out in the open for people to look at and make fun of.
Yeah. Lots of flesh in this movie, as you would probably guess. Not as much as there could have been, actually. I was expecting it to be, you know, raunchier, I guess. But, yeah.
Well, they had, in the bonus features on Filmstruck, they had certain moral codes to go by. And so,
I see.
Suzuki was very concerned about how to portray nudity, because this was an adult feature, which means not pornographic, but it was, you know, a little, more adult.
Yes.
And that was his instructions from the studio. And each prostitute in it wears a different color, so you know who they are. Like, one wears a very bright red, one wears a bright green, one wears a yellow, one wears, purple.
So they're like Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, something like that.
I see. Yeah. And then Joe Shishido shows up again with his weird-ass face.
Yeah, his puffy cheeks, and he's a convict on the run, because he stabbed someone. And, the women kind of all fall for him, and the new girl kind of gets obsessed with him, and then gets away for free, and then she gets kicked out.
I mean, he's basically holding them hostage in a kind of a weird way. I mean, he doesn't, other than being a man, he doesn't, like, have a weapon or something that he's wielding against them, but he plays a grade-A asshole in this.
Yeah. I really like this one because it's kind of ridiculous, and it's also one of the few Japanese movies of this era that I've seen that's very female focused.
Yeah.
And I just like this one a lot. It's Watching it a second time, I forgot they kill an animal on screen.
What are we talking about, a chicken?
No, they kill a cow on screen.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And he's like, I brought this cow. What are we supposed to do with that? I don't know, eat it. Jeez.
And yeah, when we see him, Joe Shishido, kill that cow on screen.
Yeah.
And it's, if you're going to watch a movie, just know that happens. I think it's an hour in, it happens.
Yeah. Do you feel like this had more of a Suzuki, like, starting to come into his own?
Yeah, to me it feels like, for me it's like the perfect balance of, like, him telling a straight story and, like, his crazy experimental side.
Right. At this point, he still had a firm hand on him, but he was letting his freak flag fly a little. We got those bright colors to show, you know, he definitely enjoyed making the colors pop off the screen.
Yeah, and the interview with the set designer on this one, they, like always, didn't have enough money to build a set, and so they used stuff from the studio. So all the signs in the movie were just, like, used props from other movies or signs from the area that were not used. So all the signs with, like, all the signs are, like, broken down and burnt and stuff were really, like, just signs from the, like, around the studio, basically.
Yeah.
That, and things like to save money on paint, they would mix it with, they'd buy, like, a certain type of paint that was cheap, and they'd mix it with sawdust, so it was thicker, so you won't need multiple coats of paint. You can just do one coat.
Sure.
Yeah, like, they did a lot, and it was all one set. Like, all the different, like, the location of the movie is all this one giant set. And they just had stuff, like, I don't know, like, they make it seem like a big town, but it's actually just like five different sections that are all connected to each other.
That cow must have cost most of the budget.
maybe.
Now, yeah, I really liked this movie. It is another high recommend. I don't think I liked it as much as Take Aim at the Police Fan, but honestly, it's been a while since I've seen Take Aim. I don't think that I wouldn't like Take Aim at this point, but, like, they're probably on even keel for me in my brain. Hmm. Like, Gate of Flesh should be watched.
Yeah, it's one of, it's female focused, and it's not feminist.
No.
Not really.
No.
But, you know, it's the rare time in these, like, old Japanese movies where you get to see, like, besides Ozu, doing a movie focused on women.
Yeah. Multiple female protagonists.
Yeah, and they're all given names, and kind of similar personalities, but, you know, it's step in the right direction.
Yep.
And it's the first of the Prostitute Trilogy, or Flesh Trilogy. I haven't seen the other two yet, but plan on it.
Mm.
So, yep. Next,
get on that Prostitute Trilogy.
You watch, hey, they're all done by Suzuki. You'd probably like it.
Probably.
Alright, so next up is Tokyo Drifter.
Tokyo Drifter.
1966.
It's about an American student who moves to Japan with his kind of estranged father, and he gets in with a bunch of Tokyo racers who focus on drifting mainly, which is when you brake in a car while you're making a turn. Wait, what?
That's the Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift.
Oh, okay.
That's the one set in the future.
Okay.
Yeah, it's that one. Never mind. That's not important.
set in the future of Fast and the Furious universe.
The timeline of those movies is weird. That one is set in, like, the near future. And Fast 7 takes place right before Fast... Never.
No. Fast 6 takes place before Fast 3.
I thought it was 7.
No, 7 is when we return to, like, the straight timeline again.
Oh, yeah, because 6 is when you see Jason Statham kill Han. There we go.
Right.
There, yeah.
And then the Tokyo Drifter shows up.
Yeah, and he sings that song.
Yep. Something about, I'm a Tokyo Drifter. I never know what I'm going to drift to. Drifting's pretty cool. So, Tokyo Drifter, 1966. It's a movie about a goofus whose name is Tetsu.
The Iron Man?
I'm calling him... Yeah, that's him. Calling him a goofus. I like this movie, but the character is... most of the characters in this movie are goofuses. This is a heavy style movie. Like, the editing goes all over the place. We're going from action movie to comedy to musical to, you know...
It looks like a music video.
Yeah. Very...
Like, there are rooms that are just, like, the walls are all red and everyone in the room is wearing red type thing.
Yep.
And it looks really cool.
For some reason, you don't see the main antagonist's face behind sunglasses, and then sometimes you just do. I don't know if it was supposed to be a big reveal, but I don't know.
Yeah, Suzuki wanted Joe Shishido. Uh-huh. The studio said, nope, you have to get this other guy.
He's busy.
And this was a pop song movie where there was a pop song written around the movie, and so it had to be featured in the film.
Makes sense. Yeah, our antagonist him and his boss have decided to retire from the gangster business. He's going to go legit. And Tetsu is known to be like a killer, a straight cold-blooded killer. And everyone's trying to test him. You know, they keep pushing him to see if he's finally going to snap and become the previous person he was. But instead, he decides to leave town after a series of events where his boss is going to end up losing these club rights because Tetsu is just too good, I guess.
Yeah, he's called the Phoenix for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Also, the evil boss wants his girl.
Oh, yeah.
But we follow Tetsu around, who is being constantly followed, specifically by another character, the Viper, whose name is Tatsu, which was extremely confusing to me.
I had the same problem.
It was like, oh, Tatsu, you're calling me. I'm like, that's not Tetsu. I'm like, oh, Tatsu, not Tetsu. Whatever. Weirdos. And then he meets up with another retired killer. I can't remember what his nickname is. It's like Munchie. No.
They all have goofy names in this one.
There's Viper and the Phoenix, like we said, and then there was, I'm looking at the Wikipedia description, I still don't see this other character who shows up in the second half and becomes kind of a main character. But what ends up happening is Tetsu gets betrayed, he has to go back to town. He also has a girl, like we said, the bad guy wants his girl, but he doesn't really seem to care about her that much. Because he doesn't want to be held down.
Because he's like a gunslinger gone straight.
Yep. He's a man on the road. He can't stand still. He can't be held in place.
He's like a Clint Eastwood type.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you think he's going for a Clint Eastwood thing with this one?
He's going for like a...
Because this one's a Western.
It's like a mixture of Clint Eastwood and... what's the Frank Sinatra, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
I do see that.
Like, I'm a loner, but I'm also a charmer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I've got to move on, baby. And Yeah. It's this movie is almost completely style over substance. Like, but there's the style is it like it's meaty like substance would be. It's like a tofu substitute for for something. It's like to me particularly it comes off as like this kind of delicious eye candy and ear candy meal, but you did not take to it the same way.
The first time I really didn't like it. The second time I thought it was I thought it was fine. I liked the look of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Like my problem with Suzuki movies is the first act is always great. And then after that, it kind of loses me.
I can understand that. You don't really know where this movie is going to go based on the first act because it doesn't. It starts off with Tetsu getting his butt kicked in like a meetup.
Yeah,
isn't it like black and white or something like that? Like
the opening is in black and white, but yeah. You see a red toy gun, and I saw in the bonus features there's like multiple times in a movie. You see something, you see like all white or like the snow and you see something red.
I see.
Like a white wall and there's like something red on it.
And that's where Spielberg was inspired to make Schindler's List.
Possibly?
No, probably not. Yeah. I don't know. You never know. He was inspired by these people. Yeah. But yeah.
I don't think Spielberg would be a Suzuki guy.
I mean, he was definitely a Kurosawa guy.
Yeah, well, clearly in Ozu, but I don't think...
Suzuki hated him, you know, maybe. Maybe he didn't go that way. Who knows?
I don't know Steven, so I shouldn't say.
Yeah? So I feel like this is a perfectly good watchable movie. This is the kind of movie I'd be like, oh, you guys want to watch a fun Japanese movie? Well, let's watch this. Not necessarily like, I'm going to sit down and study Tokyo Drifter.
What kind, well, I don't know my favorite part of Tokyo Drifter.
Which part?
The at the end showdown. Mm-hmm. They're in the room that I think is all yellow.
Yeah.
And he's wearing a yellow suit.
Yep.
And he tosses the gun in the air and then sprints and catches it and kills the bad guy.
Yep.
It's so goofy and stupid, but it totally works.
Yeah. He does a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah, but like he just like chucks it in the air as hard as he can and just runs and it's a great moment.
He's that good. What can he do?
He's the Phoenix.
I'm having I watched this like 2 weeks ago. I'm having this visual memory of like a car being crushed.
Maybe.
I don't remember. At least not clear enough. Huh. Anyways, it's not like an important scene. I just feel like it was one of the many like song breaks because there were
several.
like three or four, maybe more than that.
Yeah, because I mentioned earlier, it was a pop song movie, and Nikatsu Studios told Suzuki, you have to include these songs in it.
Mm.
Figure it out.
He did a good enough job.
Yeah. And so now to the last movie of the first half of his career before he became a critic darling. Branded the Kill.
This is where you just like fly off, right?
Well, the first time I saw Branded the Kill, I really, really hated it. And then second time through, I liked it more. It's fine. Like, the whole time, the second time through, I was like, I hope this isn't the butterfly one. And then, like, oh, fuck, it is. And, well, there's one scene in particular that I think is still really terrible.
Okay.
The shootout on, like, the stone thing with the car, and he's pulling the chain.
The bridge thing? Come on.
The bridge thing. It's just real silly.
Oh, you're silly.
Okay.
This whole movie reminded me of The Tenth Victim.
I can see that.
Yeah. Except for it's not, the story is not straightforward. You're not explained what's going on in here.
Well, this movie isn't, it also isn't a commercial for Ming Tea.
Not this time.
Well, it could have been. Who knows?
Yeah. It's a commercial for rice.
Oh, yeah, because he can only get it up by smelling boiling rice.
Yeah, there's at least 5 different scenes where he's just standing over the rice, you know, the rice cooker, and he's just sniffing away. He's like, oh, yeah, there's nothing better in the world. Like, what is going on, dude?
It's a very particular fetish.
Yep. He's got to burn his ding-dong on it or something. And this is a movie with, yeah, lots of people getting shot, lots of confusing time jumps, narrative. Like, I know we only follow Joe around, and once again, it's Joe Shishido.
Big puffy cheeks.
And he's like the number two or number three?
I think he starts out number two, becomes number three.
Okay. And, you know, apparently the hitmen are ranked in a certain order, but they also have certain rules. Like, they have to stay sober, and I can't remember. Oh, what was the other one?
I don't remember.
Okay, well, he ends up cracking up because he meets this girl, this woman, who, for some reason, he just immediately becomes infatuated with, you know. They paint her up to look very different than Japanese women I have seen before, though. So, I'll give them that. Do you know this actress from anything else?
Is this the one he sleeps with?
Not his, like, main girl that's always, like, jumping all over him. The one that, like, is weird.
For me, they always blend to the same character because of weird time jumps.
No. They're. I mean, like, the other one's like, no man can ever touch me. I'll kill anybody who tries. And the other one's like, I love you so much. Oh, you know.
Kind of.
Are you looking at the pictures? Look at the pictures.
Okay. Is it the one with all the eyeliner?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. She is just, he becomes obsessed with her because he can't, I don't know if he can't seduce her or just the way she looks or whatever. And she's talking.
The one who wishes to die?
Yes, that's her.
Okay.
And she hires him to kill somebody, but a butterfly lands on his sniper rifle and he misses the shot and he shoots an innocent person, which means that he is out of the game. And after that, you know, he becomes a drunken wreck. He has people coming after him to kill him. It's so anime. 100%.
Yeah, I see that.
Especially when he starts meeting up with the number one killer, who's like, this is what it takes to be a number one killer.
Yeah, that part is fun. It's like a whole, maybe like 15 minutes where they're, are they handcuffed together?
Yeah.
And they just do everything together.
Yeah.
And, like, even, like, it's really great. And the whole time, the number one's just messing with them.
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you don't sleep with your eyes open? That's what it takes to be the number one killer. Keep saying shit like that. Yeah. This movie is over the top, and I kind of loved it.
I think it's just okay.
Yeah.
I didn't hate it this time. I appreciated the weirdness of it.
Yeah.
But like the other ones, it just kind of didn't click with me.
Yeah, I know. You only like, you know, those vanilla movies like Ozu and... I don't know. I'm the one who likes Ozu.
I like Ozu too. It depends on the movie. We'll do an Ozu one at some point, but Ozu is, for me, kind of hit or miss.
Sure.
I think you understand. He's just like, either you're into the whole family drama or you're not.
Right. So, yeah, Branded to Kill. I do think people should watch it. I'm not sure it's going to be everybody's cup of tea, but it's so weird. I think people should see it.
Yeah, it is a movie worth seeing. It's Suzuki as most visually interesting. Well, I haven't seen his stuff when he became an art film director guy.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm looking at the last bunch of movies here. He's got one called Zeigarnik Weisen, which, let's see.
Based... I was looking for some of them, but, like, I didn't see if they were on Criterion. Like, I checked, and they weren't on Criterion.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know how accessible they are.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Because I want to see Princess Raccoon. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Was it?
Princess Raccoon.
Oh, the last one he made.
Yeah, the last one. The musical thing.
A princess of raccoon dog disguised as human. Huh.
So, besides Jim Jarmusch, who else do you think is influenced by, Suzuki, like, in your opinion?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear your question because you were burping.
Oh.
I'm just kidding. who else was influenced? I feel like Tarantino probably saw a bunch of this stuff and got some of that stuff out of there. You know, flashiness or whatever. Let's see, who else?
Apparently John Woo is a big Suzuki fan.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
I haven't seen any John Woo, so I don't know.
Well, people love John Woo, and I'll leave it at that.
No, I'm sure. I just have never seen his movies.
No, I understand. What I'm saying is, other people love John Woo.
Oh, you don't?
I didn't say that. I'm just saying, other people like him a lot.
Have you seen Mission Impossible 2?
Of course I have.
Okay. I hear that's the bad one.
Oh, that's the bad one.
That's why I always hear the two.
That's the bad Mission Impossible, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes. That's not the bad John Woo.
And Wong Kar-wai is apparently a big Suzuki guy.
Let me just say this about Mission Impossible 2. I remember things that happened in that movie. If you ask me about part 3 and part 4, I don't remember crap. So it's got that going at least.
True. But Wong Kar-wai is a big Suzuki fan, but like John Woo, I haven't seen any Wong Kar-wai either.
So he was influencing all these Chinese directors?
Seemed like all these Chinese and like India American dudes.
I can see Wong Kar-wai for the things like As Tears Go By and his other earlier stuff. Not the things that I think he's probably more famous for at this point, like not 2046, not In the Mood for Love. But sure, he takes it from all over the place. Mostly the whole greasy sweatiness that he's got going through all his movies carries over. How do you think Suzuki's style compared to Kurosawa?
They're both visually interesting. One is more... I guess you'd say Kurosawa's more traditional.
Right.
And more about creating like a beautiful landscape or like a, you know, like Kurosawa was a studied painting, and he has background in painting. So like to him, like creating shots is like creating a portrait or whatever.
Right.
Where Suzuki, from what I saw. I didn't see any art background, but he has to have some background in art. to like just have these crazy ideas.
He at least worked with somebody who had, you know, ideas of the way to set dress, the way to use colors. Because, like, I mean, you can't watch Tokyo Drifter without being like, okay, some of these can be taken frame by frame to be like hung as a painting.
Yeah, Suzuki is prints the opposite of Kurosawa, where it's just very abstract and very untraditional. Like, I've seen it described as like 60s pop art.
Yeah,
I've seen 60s pop art, but I don't know.
I mean, you feel some Andy Warhol going on there.
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, Branded to Kill definitely is like, it's got a bunch of scenes where it's just like, yeah, the kind of thing that's playing in one of those 60s dance parties. And yeah.
I don't know. Is there anything else about Suzuki you want to say?
No, I'm looking forward to seeing more of his movies. So I'll get back to later in our Japanese watch-throughs, if I watch any more, tell you what I think.
We might do one if there was, I don't know. I have to see what years movies came out, but...
Sure.
I don't know if there are any that cross out. Oh, Lupin the Third crosses over.
Yeah.
Well, I have something picked out for that already, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, yep. Got plugs?
Well, as usual, listen to our normal episodes.
Yeah. Watch these will be every so often.
Yeah. Special director-focused episodes, especially when we're picking other things, but we don't want to ignore an auteur like this.
Yeah.
If you want to hear me and Spencer talk about some science fiction and fantasy movies, my podcast, Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space, has a couple episodes, including a Japanese movie called The Face of Another. Really good movie. That's on Filmstruck. You should check that movie out if you get a chance. But we cover a new science fiction and or fantasy movie on every Monday. Coming up very soon, we're going to have... actually, by the time this episode comes out, it'll probably already be out, but we're going to be covering Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, along with everyone else, but we're joined by the amazing Gina Radcliffe, who guested on High and Low.
Yeah, she's a good person.
Yep.
I like to call her G-Rad CC.
Sounds good.
G-Rad CC's Pizza.
CC's Pizza. Man, what is wrong with you?
It fits with her name. G-Rad CC's Pizza.
Oh, man. Okay. I won't even tell you what's going on with that.
Yep. Okay. So, I'm not sure when I'll put this up. Maybe soon, maybe not.
Sure.
But, I write for Cinema Knife Fight. My next few reviews, I review old TV shows and old TV movies, or science fiction, horror, whatever, you know, stuff like that. So coming up, I have Genesis 2, a really interesting, I guess, TV movie by Gene Roddenberry. It's supposed to be a big follow-up to Star Trek, but it never quite happened for obvious reason. Because, watch Genesis 2 on YouTube. If you watch it, you'll get why it never became a series. And after that, I'm going to do a Twilight Zone review on the episode Jess Bell, about a girl who becomes a witch, but she turns into a leopard every night for some reason. It's really stupid, but I like it. So, I got that, and
sounds good to me. See you next time for a regular episode, folks.
Yep, the next special episode will probably be on Ozu, where it'll be like a movie from a non-Kurosawa year. I'm not sure which.
Sounds good.
Yep. Yep. Alfida Zane, # Hootie Tootie Disco Cutie.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Bullshit artist.
You can email our show at highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. Please rate and review wherever you listen to or find our podcast. Art, the logo is by Aaron Cornelia, and the theme song is by David DeRoy. Thank you for listening.